How would you like to live mortgage-free and accelerate financial freedom? In today's episode, Neil Henderson will tell us how to do this. And what's so special about Neil is he's a professional real estate investor, co-host of the podcast Truly Passive Income, and general partner at Nomad Capital, a self-storage syndication firm based in Wilmington, North Carolina, that specializes in conversions. And he has been integral to over $75 million in commercial real estate transactions and part of a team that has raised over $17 million in investor equity for self-storage acquisitions. Nomad Capital's growing portfolio acquired alongside investors includes over 311,000 net rentable square feet of operational self-storage facilities with several more in development. So tell us, Neil, what does that mean to live mortgage-free and accelerate financial freedom? How can someone do that?
Welcome to Awakened Titans Podcast with Lily Patrescu, mind-blowing conversations with influential business titans sharing how you can manifest abundance, love, joy, success through quantum awakening, quantum manifestation, quantum healing, quantum miracles, exponential business growth, and innovative products and services.
Well, Lily, first, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. Well, I think that most people are so focused on lowering the small little things that eat into their budget that they miss the big things. And that's great. You should try to remove those little, you know, budget nibblers, as I call them. But to really, really accelerate your path to financial freedom, I think you need to focus on some of the biggest expenses that most people have in their life: their mortgage, their car payment, and their taxes. And if you can lower or eliminate the cost of your mortgage, you're going to be far ahead of 95% of the population.
Great. So tell us, how can someone do that? How can someone live mortgage-free?
Well, the technical term for it is house hacking. But it's essentially, you know, most people, you buy a house just to live in. House hacking essentially is trying to find a way to live in that property while also earning a little bit of an income on it. That can be from either buying a duplex, triplex, or fourplex and living in one unit. It can be if you have a guest house on a single family home, an ADU that you rent out either long-term, medium-term, short-term. It can be, you know, I know some young people who rent by the room. They buy a house, they're near university, and they will rent by the room to other college students. But essentially what you're trying to do is lower or completely eliminate your mortgage with the income that you're bringing in from the other tenants.
Thank you. So what else is there to it?
Well, I can tell you how I got into it. And from my experience, some of the things that we had to consider and what we went through, I sort of fell into it. We bought a house in Las Vegas, Nevada in the summer of 2013. It had a little guest house on the front of it. For about 30 seconds, it was going to be my ultimate man cave before my wife said, oh no, that's going to be our main guest room where people come and stay with us. We outfitted that room like a small little hotel room, not really thinking anything beyond that. And we put in a little miniature fridge, a coffee bar, you know, and just appointed it like a nice little hotel room. And on Christmas Day of 2013, my mom handed me this article about this company called Airbnb. And she said, I think you should maybe think about renting out that little guest house at the front of your property on this platform. I was like, yeah, whatever, mom. But I went away and I thought about it. And in January of 2014, I went out, I'm a photographer, I went out, I took some photos of the space, and I listed it on Airbnb, and within 48 hours, we had our first booking, and for the next 6 years, we were 65% occupied, one of the highest rated short-term rental listings in Las Vegas, Nevada at the time, and it paid our mortgage and more. We actually were able to put extra money away each month on our mortgage to pay down our mortgage a lot faster. Knowing what I know now, I probably wouldn't do that because we had a pretty good rate as it was. But that absolutely threw gasoline on the fire that was my financial life. I mean, it, in a good way, not a bad way. It just accelerated our path to financial independence.
Thank you. Once someone sets up this kind of way to live mortgage-free, what should they put in place?
Well, in our case, we were doing a short-term rental. You need to, you know, when we started off, we didn't know what we didn't know. There weren't as many systems and external software of a service things that support short-term rental owners now. The main thing, I mean, when we first started out, we were cleaning the place. We were doing the turnovers all on our own. My wife and I, you know, rain or shine, no matter what was going on, if we had a turnover, we would have to go out there and clean the space. We did that for probably the first year that we were in operation. And then eventually we hired a cleaner and then you have to figure out how to communicate with that cleaner to let them know that there's a turnover. How to pay them efficiently and how to make sure that they're cleaning it to your specifications, because it's not a lot of cleaners will come in and they'll just kind of clean it like it's like your own personal space, and that's usually not quite up to the standards of somebody who's coming to stay there short term. You need to figure out how to handle guest check-in at all hours of the day. We had to in that case, we didn't have an electronic lock on that unit. We essentially just had a lock, a key underneath a welcome mat. And we would have to, you know, the day before somebody arrived, we'd send them an email that says, hey, here's how you check in. Here's where to get the key. But if you have a Wi-Fi lock that's got a rotating code, you need to know how to set that up on your CRM so that that changes each time and checks, you know, it activates about an hour before they check in and deactivates about an hour after they check in. You need to have guest communication dialed in. A lot of times you can mostly get away with about 5 or 6 automated messages that, you know, automate from, you know, when they book your place, a couple of days before they check in, the day after they check in, to just do a checkup. Hey, how's everything going? Is there anything you need? A reminder that they got to check out, and giving them this checkout instructions. And then finally, kind of a post checkout reminder to leave you a review. And then you need to sort of have set up different communications around, you know, the frequently asked questions. You know, are there restaurants in the area? You know, if you have a Wi-Fi lock, is there a backup key location you can point people to, and various things like that?
Thank you. I've done Airbnb before and it has worked out, although I did find it very, very annoying. And the reason why I find it very annoying is because versus like a long-term rental, you know, like you have all sorts of customers and yeah, sometimes they will stay like 1 month or 2 months, and that's a little bit less hassle. But for people that stay like a lower number of days, it can be very annoying because, let's say I had one person that stayed for 2 weeks and then complained to Airbnb and then said, oh, actually there was this issue and this other issue, therefore I would like a refund after staying 2 weeks. And they did get one. And the other thing that I find that Airbnb has become a lot stricter with is, certain issues that may come up, and then if you don't meet those terms and whatever, then they will put up the guest in a hotel and they will get you to pay for it, and they will refund the guest as well. So it has, you know, it used to be a lot easier in the past and not so much now. And I'm wondering about what do you put in place to make sure that your rental is relatively secure in terms of the kind of income you can actually make based on the new kind of stricter terms of Airbnb.
Yeah. You bring up a fantastic point, Lily, is that it's not all sunshine and rainbows. You need to realize if you're doing a short-term rental, you are you're very much in a very high touch, customer service centric business. And you can have as many as, well, I mean, conceivably, depending on how long, what your minimum stay is, you could have 30 different guests a month. Now, I don't suggest you do it that way. I suggest you have some kind of minimum, at least 2 nights, 3 nights. But, you know, you can have 15 different customers a month. I think you need to be very mindful of how you are portraying your listing. You need to be make it very clear what people are getting when they check in or when they book your place. I think sometimes people think that, you know, I need to kind of show it a little bit better than it is. And you really want it to look like it looks when they walk in the door. And that's, you know, and I will say that your experience, you know, I've been an Airbnb host now for, 2014 is when I started. I'm still hosting, so over 12 years. And my experience has been 98% positive. Those 2% are hair-pulling moments. They're, you know, we almost got kicked off the platform when we asked the guest who lived downstairs from us and shared a ventilation system with us to please obey the house rules and don't smoke pot. They accused us of invading their privacy and accused us of having cameras on the property, and Airbnb ended up similar to what you experienced, that they checked out. We actually did not end up having to pay for them to be placed into a new unit, but we lost that income immediately. And, you got to realize that the nights that people are staying are a perishable product. Once they're gone, you're not going to get them back. And it was during a pretty high, you know, it was a high summer season. And then Airbnb launched an investigation saying that, you know, we had cameras in the unit. So, the best advice I can give you, which is what I said, is just make sure that you are communicating with guests. Be cautious. Like if your spidey sense is tingling and telling you that this is not somebody you'd want to host in your place, don't do it. No money is worth it. I've had numerous people who, you know, the first time that they interact with them, they come in asking for a discount. I usually just say, nope, the price is the price. It's just not, we're not in that business. If you want to negotiate, go somewhere else. There's plenty of other places to stay. It's usually kind of I've done that a few times and it's almost always been a problem guest. The other piece of advice I would give is don't be all in on Airbnb. Set up a system to do direct bookings. Set up, you know, be on VRBO, be on booking.com, and be on Airbnb. Now, that said, Airbnb is the 800-pound gorilla in the room. That's where most people are going to come through. But if you have set up systems where you've constantly been talking to people and you've been setting up direct booking systems, you can sort of insulate yourself from that potential of getting kicked off the Airbnb platform, which would be devastating if that's the only way that you, only booking channel that you had. But again, you know, this is not, it's not for everyone. It's a high touch business. I have never scaled my business beyond the one listing that I have, that I live above. We use it as a house hack. The people that I know that do this with a lot of listings, it's a full-time job unless you really know how to build a team and build systems. And it's not truly passive income, as we often say. And it is, you know, if you are somebody who doesn't like getting communications from guests at 10 p.m. complaining about the air vent blowing on them, then it's probably not for you. And I don't suggest that you do this. There's nothing that's going to be worth the aggravation that's going to keep you up at night.
Thank you. Did you decide to talk about how to live mortgage-free and accelerate financial freedom with Airbnb listings, mainly because you found that to be like the primary foundation for any investor to start creating truly passive income afterwards with other methods?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Okay, so what I meant was like, did you choose this particular topic to discuss how to live mortgage free? Because actually that's the core thing you have to do as a foundation before you actually start perhaps investing in self-storage units or something
Got it.
else. Because
Got it.
once you kind of remove that burden of, oh my God, I have to pay for the mortgage, then you can start to really think about, okay, what are some truly passive income that I can create with something else?
Absolutely. Okay. So it is absolutely not the only way. It was a life-changing experience for me. It's been a life-changing experience for my co-host and partner, Clint Harris. There's numerous other people that I know that have house hacked, and it's been a life-changing, financial life-changing experience for them. It is not the only way. Really, fundamentally, what you're trying to do is increase your savings rate. If you want to be financially free, you need to make money, and you need to live on less than you make, and invest the difference. For me, house hacking is one of the biggest levers you can pull. There also, you can just be somebody who, I talk to investors every day who are white coat professionals, business owners, and things like that. And sometimes they'll talk about buying an Airbnb or, buying a business or buying a self-storage facility themselves. And I always recommend for people, listen, like if you are already a high income earner, keep the main thing the main thing. And find ways to just, make more than you spend. You gotta, because you're never gonna get anywhere if you're spending as much as you make, even if you're making $1 million a month. And then invest the difference into something passive, And, the joke, the sort of inside joke on our podcast, Truly Passive Income, is there's really no such thing as truly passive income beyond investing in a savings account, a money market fund, or, putting your money into low-cost index funds, which I do, which is a great way to invest. But even that requires a little bit of minding the store. And even if you choose to invest in alternative investments like real estate syndications, private equity, things like that, it is the only way to really be passive in real estate. But make no mistake, there's some work involved. You have to perform due diligence on the operator. You have to understand the asset class, and you need to just understand what it is that you're investing in, probably a lot more than an index fund that you've invested in.
Thank you. Tell us about the self-storage units that you invest in. How did you get into that? And is that a good investment arm for people that already have, let's say, started to live mortgage free?
Yeah. I really fell into self-storage. I did not, grow up dreaming of investing in self-storage. I discovered it. I went to my first commercial real estate meetup in 2017 and met my now partner who was in self-storage. And it was the first time I had ever even considered that when I drive by a self-storage facility, that it's actually owned by people. And that's the thing that a lot of people don't understand about commercial real estate. When you drive by an apartment building or a self-storage facility or a medical office building or a big office building, it's not usually owned by one person. It's usually owned by a group of people like yourself through something called a syndication, which is just where a group of investors pool their capital together with the help of a sponsor, someone who's a professional operator, to buy an asset that is otherwise larger than what they could buy on their own. And I think what attracted me to self-storage was, first of all, it's a commercial asset class. And in commercial real estate, as opposed to residential real estate, is a much more predictable way to make money in real estate. You are, the values on a commercial real estate property are based on the income it produces. The gross revenue minus the expenses equals the net operating income divided by a cap rate will give you essentially the value of that property. Whereas on a residential piece of real estate, you're often looking at the comps. You know, what did people pay per square foot on a similar house or small multifamily in within a 2 or 3 mile radius within the last 6 months? And that's very dependent on just the mood of the market, the school system, things like that. And it's just not as predictable as commercial real estate. So that's why I just gravitated to towards commercial real estate. Now, and then on top of that, I wanted to invest in commercial real estate assets that had demographic tailwinds behind them. I believe that we have a housing shortage right now, and I think that multifamily, despite the challenges that it's faced over the last 4 years, is still a very good asset class that's got a lot of demographic tailwinds behind it. People need a place to live. Assisted living facilities. I think you have a silver tsunami coming, and grandma and grandpa are going to need some place to live out the final years of their life. That asset class got hit pretty hard by COVID and it's recovering, but I still think there's great demographic tailwinds behind that. And self-storage. And, you know, when I first started exploring self-storage, within about 2 years, I remember hearing that roughly 9% of all Americans used self-storage on an annual basis in some capacity. That's now up to nearly 13%. We just don't like to get rid of our stuff. And self-storage is very much a trauma and transition business. You are typically, the demand drivers are people moving. In good times and bad, self-storage has performed very well in recessions and good times, because in recessions, people are typically moving a lot. They're either downsizing, and then in good times, people are buying toys, they're doing home renovations, and they need some place to store their stuff. So that was really what attracted me to it. It's a very simple business model. You're renting a box of air to people. It's month-to-month leases. There's not 12-month leases. You can literally change the rent every month if you want. And there's no toilets, trash, or tenants, really. It's really a much simpler business model than multifamily. As much as I love the multifamily asset class, it's just a simpler model.
Thank you. So tell us about self-storage units. How does it work in terms of someone who, let's say, wants to get into this kind of investment? What's the minimum they would have to put down, and how does it work exactly?
Well, it depends on who the operator is. You know, you're typically looking at a syndication. Most syndicators, it's going to be a $50,000 minimum. They may be, if it's a 506B offering, they can take non-accredited investors, but oftentimes it's really hard to hear about those because you have to have a pre-existing relationship with the syndicator in order. And then there's 506C, which we call sort of crowdfunding, where you'll see ads on Facebook for investing in multifamily self-storage, things like that. And typically, you know, we advertise on Meta, and people will click on the ad. They'll fill all of a little information about themselves. They'll get contacted by us either by phone call or email. Usually schedule a call with myself or my partner, and we'll sit down and talk to people like, what are you trying to achieve? What's your goal? And I think that's something very important for people to understand before they come in. A lot of times people just see, oh, self-storage. I've heard that's a cash cow. And then they end up investing $50,000 in a development deal that doesn't cash flow for, you know, 4 to 5 years. And so I think it's very important for us as syndicators to understand what's the goal that you're trying to achieve before you invest. If you're just looking to place your capital with somebody and then have it grow and come out the other side, you know, two to three times more in 3 to 5 years, great. That's, you know, You know, there's probably an investment out there for you. If you're looking for immediate cash flow to replace a job that you want to walk away from, you probably don't want to invest into a self-storage development deal. But sometimes there's opportunity to buy into an existing self-storage facility that needs an operational turnaround and make cash flow a lot sooner.
Thank you. So imagine that I invest $50,000 into a self-storage syndication. Does that mean that, let's say, if the units that are kind of corresponding to whatever I bought are empty, does that mean I don't make anything? Or does it kind of get split somehow so that evenly in a way that I still make some income, even if my personal units are going to be empty? Or is it that I actually don't get assigned a particular unit, and that way it kind of doesn't matter? It's more like a percentage of the entire thing, and that way I always kind of like make income regardless of whether a particular number of units in the building are actually empty.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's the latter. I mean, when you are investing in a syndication, you're investing in the overall property. You are, and that's one of the nice things, is that you're diversified across, you know, 500-600 units. You're not just buying ownership on, you know, the 10 by 10 units in this little section of the facility. You have equity in the entire project, which includes you are getting a benefit on the taxes, on the equity in the project if it ever sells, and the cash flow if and when the property produces cash flow.
Thank you. What are some returns that some current people that you've worked with have managed to get from syndication of self-storage units?
Are you asking what sort of returns people have been able to get?
Yes. Yeah.
So we exited we did a Kmart conversion in May. We bought it in May of 2022, finished the conversion about a year later, and we just exited that deal in July of 2025. We were projecting, I think, a 17% and 19% IRR, depending on which class of investor we had, and we hit an 18% and a 20% IRR in 37 months. That's typically what we're targeting. It very much depends on what kind of deal it is. If it's an existing facility that's maybe already got some cash flow on it, that's just a sort of operational turnaround, it may be a lower IRR, maybe, you know, down in the 13% to 16%. If it's a very heavy value add, if it's a full up development deal, you know, the returns could be, you know, 20% to 30%. Something you need to understand when we're talking about returns is that there's a correlation between the risk profile and the return profile. You know, you're taking on more risk the higher the return that's being projected. And then, you know, we're very much, there's a real move right now, what we call a flight to liquidity, going on right now with a lot of people who have invested in real estate syndications and private equity over the last 2 years. It's been a really rough time in multifamily, anybody who's been involved in multifamily. And so a lot of people have gotten burned by these 3 to 5 year holds, you know, value add, things like that. So right now, we're very much trying to figure out how we can put together offerings that are a little bit more of a debt offering, where we'll say, listen, we're going to pay you, I don't know, anywhere from 10 to 20% annualized over a 2 year period, and then you're out. And I think there's a real market for that. Investors have been really kind of burned by these, you know, 3 to 5 year deals that sometimes turn into 5 to 7 year deals where there's capital calls and things like that. And so, you know, we're trying to respond to the market and offer up investors what they're looking for.
Thank you. Tell us more about the self-storage syndication units. Do you specialize in conversions or in development deals, or do you specialize in adding value to whatever is already available in terms of operational excellence and like a turnaround or something else that isn't mentioned here?
Yeah. So there's four primary self-storage strategies. There's ground-up development, which we've done. There's conversions, taking an existing building that's something else and doing adaptive reuse and turning it into self-storage. There's buying an existing facility that needs that maybe needs an operational turnaround. It's being managed by a mom and pop, and they're not really managing it professionally. And then there's what we call an expansion opportunity, where you're buying an existing facility that maybe has some extra land and you're able to expand it and add value that way. We have done all four of those. Our favorite strategy over the last 4 years has been conversions. That's just been where the opportunity has been. Now, the next question you should ask would be, why is that? So on average, if you and I were to go out and build a self-storage facility from the ground up over the last few years, it's going to cost us about $120 to $140 a square foot, not including the cost of the land to build that facility. Our last six conversion projects we have bought and built out for an average of $65 a square foot. And that includes the acquisition, the land, the building, and the construction. On top of that, typically it only takes us from the time that we acquire it to the time that we open about 12 to 15 months to get certificate of occupancy and start leasing it up. Whereas right now, the average time to do a ground up development is about 2 years and 10 months. So the conversions have been faster and cheaper, which just puts us at a huge competitive advantage compared to the rest of the market. That said, we are entering a cycle right now where ground-up development, I think, is becoming a more viable opportunity if you have a good construction team behind you, which we do. We have our own internal construction team. And so we are starting to explore those opportunities again. We're also exploring buying some existing facilities, because you've got a lot of baby boomer owners who are nearing retirement and they're just ready to hang it up. And there's just a lot more opportunity coming back onto the market where we can acquire some of those facilities as well.
Thank you. Tell us about what turned you into the Speedy Gonzalez of the self-storage units. What makes this process so much faster and so much better than other companies who are doing similar things?
So first of all, is we have our own internal construction team. We're general contractors. Our founders, Eric and Levi Hemingway, were contractors way back in the Eric is the father. He was a contractor back in the early 90s. He's been a general contractor, commercial real estate developer for 30 years now. He built his first self-storage facility from the ground up in 2006. So we are, it very much matters that we have our own internal construction team, because if we need to make a change, it's literally a walk down the hall and we talk to somebody and we tell them what we need. And it gets changed within a week, as opposed to having to call up the contract that we've hired, tell them what we need, have them send us what they're going to do. And then us respond back and say, no, that's not what we want. And this back and forth. That makes those change orders get very, very expensive, both from a financial side and just a timing side. Also with development, when you're doing ground development, you're often dealing with, you're dealing with entitlements, permitting, zoning, putting in the infrastructure, grading the land, all that. Whereas with a conversion opportunity, we don't have to do that. It's already, the building already exists. It's usually permitted for commercial real estate already. There's often a conditional use permit that we're able to use to, storage is available, is permitted by right. The electrical's already there. The building's already there. The infrastructure's already there. And the parking lot's already there. Four things, I would say, our internal construction team, not having to do permitting and zoning, not having to do land entitlement, not having to do, land prep, are probably the four reasons that conversion is so much faster than ground up development.
Thank you. What did you put in place to reduce the risk for investors that want to invest with you in self-storage syndication, in self-storage units?
Yeah, I would say the biggest thing is our cost basis. We are when somebody buys into one of our projects, like I said, we're on average we're all in for about $65 a square foot. Oftentimes, once we open the doors, we've got an empty self-storage facility, and oftentimes the bank will come in and reappraise the building now as a self-storage facility. And a lot of times they'll say, "All right, it's now worth $8 million." When it cost us $6 million to build it out. Now, there's a margin of safety right there. If we had to absolutely fire sell it right then and there, oftentimes we at worst could get the investors their original capital back. But you are just that margin of safety, and then now you start leasing up the facility, and every unit that you add is usually going to add value to it as you go. And I would say that's the biggest margin of safety that we have is just our low cost basis.
Thank you. How long will it take for someone to start seeing their returns?
That's a great question. And it's a tough one to answer. It depend very much depends on the project. For a ground up development, if you were to go from let's not say ground up development, let's say a conversion opportunity. If you were to invest on day one when they acquire the building, you're looking at investing your money before they acquire the building. Maybe they acquire it a month later. Now you're talking 12 to 15 months for it to build out. And then typically in a normal self-storage market, you're talking about 24 months to lease up to what we would call stabilization, which is about 85% occupancy, the facility's producing positive cash flow and things like that. So about an average of 36 to 48 months, I would say. There are instances where it's just in a great area and it leases up faster, or you just have an offer come around from a buyer that just is too good to pass up, which is sort of what happened with our Danville property. We just had a great offer, and it was a chance for us to get out after 37 months, and the investors got their money back. It has been an extraordinarily challenging time in self-storage for the last 3 years. It's been one of the hardest times in self-storage for the last 3 decades, I'd say. Typically, a self-storage facility in a normal market would lease up at about 3% per month occupancy-wise, meaning that if you had a brand new empty facility, it would lease up to stabilization in about 24 to 30 months. Well, after COVID, coming out of COVID, that housing market froze, and a lot of people are just not moving as much as they were pre-COVID and beyond that. And lease up velocity actually dropped down to 1%, 1.5%. And now things can take 48, 56 months to lease up. Now that is starting to change, where the market's starting to normalize a little bit more. We still do have what I would call a frozen housing market, but it is starting to ease up a little bit. People are just sort of normalizing to the price of housing, and people are starting to, life goes on, they have to move. And so we are seeing that lease up velocity return to a more normal rate right now.
Thank you. What are the top questions that property investors ask you about self-storage units?
I would say, when can I expect my money back? What is my money being used for? And that's typically, and whether or not I'm going to see any sort of cash flow from the asset, at what point? That's the most common question people are asking is, am I going to start seeing cash flow within a year, 2 years, 3 years? And I think that's a very important thing to understand. I would say we have over 130 investors, individual investors who are in deals with us. 99% of them are happy with us. even on deals that are maybe not going exactly how we predicted, that 1% that are not happy do a great job of vetting those investors beforehand to explain to them whether or not they were going to get cash flow at what phase. And they're now upset because they were thinking they were going to get cash flow sooner. So I think it's very important when people are going into one of these investments to understand what the timeline and business plan is, and understanding that if you're investing in a development deal, it's probably not going to cash flow for a long time. If you're looking for immediate cash flow, I think you're better off either trying to find something like a debt fund where you're investing on the debt side and there's immediate cash flow, either monthly, quarterly, annually, or buying into an existing asset that has existing cash flow.
Thank you. How does investing in self-storage units differ versus other investment opportunities available? Why would someone choose investing in a self-storage syndication firm versus investing in other?
Sure. To narrow it down a little bit, I'll say, all right, let's. Our primary competitions are typically multifamily, hotels, large industrial, things like that. There was a recent study that said that storage has outperformed all other asset classes, including the S&P 500, since 1992. The average annualized return on self-storage has been north of 18%, compared to the S&P 500, which has been like 11%. Multifamily has been about 13%. Now, why is that? One, it's a very recession-resilient asset class because you can literally change your pricing every month. The only thing that can change prices faster are hotels, because it's literally on a night-to-night basis. The other thing I would say is that your expense ratio on self-storage is lower than almost any other asset class. On multifamily, typically they'll say that you're going to be able to keep about 50% of whatever gross revenue you make, not including the debt service. So 50 cents of every dollar you get to keep, not including whatever you're paying for the debt. On self-storage, it averages about 35%. And we found that typically the longer you hold a facility, that expense ratio starts to go down. Our facility in Arizona that we've been in operation since 2007, the expense ratio is like 19 to 20%. So that's why, often people talk about storage as printing money. That's the kind of facility they're talking about. One that's just been around a while. You've worked out most of the marketing costs. People know it's there and it's a very simple thing and it just prints money. That would be the primary reasons that I like the asset class personally more than those others. And I do invest. I invest in multifamily. I've invested in industrial. I have not yet invested in hotels.
Thank you. For those property investors wanting to invest in self-storage syndication units, syndication firms, what would you say are the primary criteria they should be looking at, assuming they want to invest in a place that's kind of local to their area?
I would say the first thing that you are looking for is just experience in the asset class. There's a lot of people that got into multifamily syndication over the last 5 years that had almost no experience managing an asset of that size or that asset type. Some of them came in it from zero experience. Some of them came in from, much smaller experience. I would say, this applies to self-storage, as it applies to multifamily, as it applies to industrial. You're looking for someone who has been executing the business plan that they are proposing to you numerous times, successfully, unsuccessfully. It's okay. Like, if they've had instances where it's been unsuccessful, find out why. Sometimes that's not necessarily a bad thing. Obviously, you want to see more winners than losers, but you want to understand, what did they do when something went bad. You want to see a track record that shows that they have been in this asset class for a while. You don't want to be investing with somebody who's taking investor capital and they've never done this before. They've just decided that, oh, I think I want to do self-storage now. And I was doing multifamily before. I was doing car washes. You want to invest with somebody who's been in this asset class for a while. Like I said, executing whatever that business plan is that you specifically are investing in now.
Thank you. Tell us about what kind of location would make a self-storage syndication, what kind of location would make like a self-storage investment a good one? Like where would someone look to kind of invest to make sure that that kind of place is actually ideal for investment in terms of like cash appreciation and overall being able to quickly rent it out?
Yeah, very great question. Self-storage is a very, you know, with all real estate, location, location, location. Self-storage is no different. It's a very localized market. When we talk about self-storage, we're usually talking about a 1, 3, and 5 mile trade area, meaning that the average person is not going to drive an extraordinarily long distance to go store their stuff at your location. It's a kind of a commodity business. They're not, you know, there's no brand loyalty. They're not going to say, well, I'm really a public storage person, or I'm really an extra space storage, so I'm going to drive all the way across town to store my stuff at an extra space. There needs to be good visibility. It needs to be in, you know, it used to be self-storage was often in sort of industrial areas, maybe kind of away from the typical retail corridor. That's changed a lot now. Most self-storage facilities are going to be in the heart of a retail corridor where you can see Walmart and smell McDonald's, because you want to be in that path of where people are going every day when they drive from work and home, where they're driving to do their shopping, you know, eat at restaurants, things like that. You want to be visible. And the other thing is there demand for storage in that area? We talk about that the biggest enemy of self-storage is more self-storage. Self-storage has a very, what we would call market equilibrium. The average sort of the rule of thumb that people talk about is that you want less than 7 square feet of self-storage per capita in a, you know, a 1, 3, or 5 mile radius. That is very ballpark. That is kind of the national average. If you have less than 7 square feet, people will tend to say that your market is undersupplied. If you've got more, they would typically say that it's oversupplied. Being a very data-driven company, and most smart real estate investors are getting much more granular with that data now, because you can go into a market where there's 12 square feet per capita. I've seen as high as 15 square feet per capita, and every facility in that area is full because there's just something about that market that drives a need for storage. So you really can't just look at, you know, well, if there's more than seven square feet per capita, I'm staying away from that area. You need to look at what are the rents that they're able to charge in that area. If they're able to charge, you know, upwards of $17 to $20 a square foot for those storage units, then that's probably a pretty good market, especially if you're calling around to all the other facilities and they're full. And I don't care if they've got 18 square feet per capita. The other thing to consider is if you are planning to build self-storage in an area, you need to be mindful of how much supply you are adding to that market. You know, if you're adding 100,000 square feet of self-storage to an area that's already got 18 square feet per capita, you better have a pretty good understanding of how much supply that area needs before you plop that much down into an area.
Thank you. So how do you gauge the need for self-storage units? Is it just based off the fact that, let's say, the rents in that particular area are really high. Therefore, it kind of would make sense for someone to use a self-storage unit rather than actually rent of an apartment or something. Or are there any other criteria that would help you to gauge what are the potential needs of self-storage units?
Yeah, I would say we're looking for an area that's just where there's just population growth. We don't typically want to be in, you can buy in areas where the population growth is kind of flat, but we're probably not going to build more self-storage there. So if we're looking to build somewhere, we want some kind of population growth. You want a good job market, preferably a diverse employment base. You don't necessarily want just one major employer, because if that employer, folds up their tent and moves out of town, the town's going to be in real trouble. You want an area that has preferably a higher percentage of renters. Renters are like 50% more likely to use self-storage than people who own their home. So we typically are looking for greater than 25% of people in that exact area that are renters. You are typically looking for a you want a median household income north of $45,000 a year, sometimes even $55,000 a year. You can really get into a position where if it's a below that income, there may be demand for self-storage, but the people can't afford storage. So they're usually just going to either put their stuff with you and then not pay rent, and then you're going to have to end up auctioning, or they're just going to throw their stuff away. So I would say those are kind of the main demand criteria, that we're looking for out of the gate.
Thank you. Tell us where property investors can connect with you to find out more information about self-storage syndication.
The easiest thing is just go to our website, nomadcapital.us. You can also reach out to me directly, neil@nomadcapital.us, and Neil is spelled NEIL.
Thank you.
Follow us for more interviews with world's most influential business titans, providing you with the insights to awaken to your full potential so you can get paid to be yourself, find true happiness, and manifest anything you desire.